Switching gears now, though, ever wonder about the wild and fabulous lives of UFO investigators? The parties, the celebrities, the fortunes to be made, right? Not exactly the way it is, though. It's a tough and lonely pursuit in many ways, fraught with peril for one's personal and professional reputation. One man who has managed to thread the needle and maintain a semblance of a normal life is my main guest tonight. His name is Bud Hopkins. You know him. He's a world-renowned author and UFO abduction researcher. He's looked into more than 700 abduction cases and continues to lead investigations into the systematic abduction of human beings by aliens, UFO occupants, whatever you want to call them. He's worked with more than 1,000 people who've reported experiences over the past 20 years and has always had a goal in mind of bringing objective, dispassionate, scientific intelligence to the UFO abduction phenomenon. Tonight, though, a look at the personal side of his research and how he has tried to balance that research with something resembling a normal life. In a moment, Life, Art, and UFOs with Bud Hopkins. Stay with us. Folks, if you spend any time at all around the UFO topic, the world of ufology, you realize pretty quickly that it is characterized by backbiting and backstabbing and infighting, egos, jealousies, incredible fights and individual differences. I mean, I am proud to say, though, that I have known and admired Bud Hopkins for more than 20 years and can say without equivocation he's one of the great gentlemen of the UFO field, and that's saying a lot, because there aren't a whole lot of those. Bud, do you realize we've known each other for more than 20 years?
I was thinking about it. It's been a long time. Yep.
Hey, I'm so glad you're with me. I wanted to check on how are you doing, health-wise and both professionally, professional-wise as well. How's things going for you?
Well, it's always complicated. The health is not great at this point, and I've been, as many people know, fighting lymphoma for years, 11 years to be exact, and that seems to be in almost remission right now, thanks to chemotherapy and so forth, but it's sort of sapped the energy, and that's one of the serious problems I'm living with now, that the old get up and go, I guess, got up and went or something at this point. So I'm having to take things easy, but still doing my work. I'm still, of course, painting. I'm working with abductees, some very interesting new cases, and but I'm doing a lot of sort of passive reading and contemplating and so forth. And partly this new situation really helped me to write my book, Art, Life, and UFOs, my memoir, because it's something I've wanted to do for years, but I guess things were going too fast for me to really have the time. And it's only in the past few years that I was able to sit down and really get the book together.
Well, I'll tell you, I finished it this afternoon. It's a wonderful book. It just humanizes the whole what it's like to jump into this particular field and then still try to balance it with any kind of a semblance of a normal life.
Well, I'm glad you liked it. It was also fun to do. I mean, I tried to make sure there was some humor involved in it, but I wanted to concentrate a little bit on my earliest years, the childhood years, because all of that is so formative for what comes later. And in terms of the UFO side of things, I think what was a sort of a negative event that I described in the book was as a child, my listening to the Orson Welles broadcasts in 1938, a famous, a famous hoax about the invasion of New Jersey by Martians. And that experience, which was terrifying to me as a little child, I think sort of switched me off to any interest in the subject. And it wasn't until I was 33 years old that I paid the slightest bit of attention to it. And that was when I had a sighting myself. But the Orson Welles thing really sort of turned off, I think, a generation of Americans from taking UFO reports seriously, because everyone thought, I'm not going to be burned twice by another hoax.
Well, there are a lot of synchronicities in your life that sort of lead you down this path to where you end up, and I want to cover some of those, as well as the amazing eclectic group of people that you met over the years. But I'll start with this, and it's sort of a general question. You know, people see you at these UFO conventions, and you've been going to them for a long time and speaking at different conferences over the years, and they think, oh, there's Bud Hopkins, the abduction guy. They don't even realize what an accomplished artist you are. And until you read this book and see who your contemporaries and colleagues are, I mean, it really doesn't set in, but you're a big guy.
Well, thanks. You know, George, one time I was invited by John Carpenter to speak at a conference, and he said, Bud, no one knows about your paintings, what they look like. He said, maybe you should show some, you know, talk about your paintings. So as a kind of private little joke, when I was introduced to speak on my subject, the UFO abduction phenomenon, I said, well, actually, John has asked me to talk about painting instead, so I have here 185 slides of my work to illustrate what I've done. And I looked over, John was standing there with his mouth open, sweating, and I did show about two or three slides of the work, and then I went back to the UFO subject, but I think I scared the daylights out of the guy. He's a very, very nice man.
I don't think anybody in the UFO field could afford one of your paintings anymore, could they? I mean, what's can you give us a number on something that you've sold that would just make my mouth
well,
drop?
Well, it's I've never hit a really high price range for many reasons. I think actually the UFO phenomenon and the research I was doing had a kind of negative effect on my market, because I think people were thinking, is this guy for real? Is he an artist after all? What is he? You know, but paintings were sold in the five figures. That's about where I my peak. But I've sold many, many small things that were more reasonable, because I like to do a lot of little things. I have a sort of a miniaturist impulse along with the idea of the grandiosity. I've done paintings 17, 18 feet in width. That's just because as an artist, you want to work a lot of different ways and different scale, different sizes. But I've shown regularly, and the last one-man show I had in New York was rather a while ago. I think it was 2007 or something like that. I've forgotten exactly. But at any rate, I've shown sometimes two and three times a year in different cities. So my work is widely known in many, many museums.
You know, one thing that was really a surprise to me in reading the book is you would think that artists would be open to the idea, the subject of UFOs, that they would have some sort of artistic sensibility and be open to different kinds of ideas and influences. And yet, as you relate, there's very little of that, that you actually ran into resistance and a lack of interest in the UFO topic over the years.
Well, that's quite true. It is odd who who was interested in the subject, sort of more or less outside their professions. And amongst painters, I haven't found really much interest. There are some people who are extremely interested. James Turrell is one of the leading artists doing a kind of perceptual installation situation where it's a little too hard to explain right now, but he's world known, but he's extremely interested in the subject. And a number of years ago, he organized a futurist conference that was held in Freiburg, Switzerland. And I was picked by him to speak on the UFO subject as a possible major futurist issue. I mean, his interest is intense, but an awful lot of people just shrug their shoulders. One of the a writer, for instance, who I knew somewhat, Donald Barthelme, actually I think a wonderful writer, when he read my article in the Village Voice about that very first case I investigated, the UFO landing in North Hudson Park, right across the Hudson River from Manhattan, when he read that article, he told me, he said, "Damn it, Bob, now I have to worry about my writing, my career, my wife, my problems." And he said, "Now I got this story about." He said, "I'm really sorry I read it," you know. And I think that that characterizes a lot of people's attitudes, that it somehow, first of all, is so strange, so outside their experience, the existence of perhaps another entire culture, technology, race, whatever, doing its thing here. It's so outside everybody's experience, unless they've had experiences, that they just don't want to deal with it. On one side, it's just easy to avoid that way. On the other side, it's really scary to think about it. It's very disconcerting, and who wants that?
Well, it's really scary. In your book, Art, Life, and UFOs, a memoir, you sort of relate how not only is it kind of an accident that you become a UFO researcher, and we'll get into how that happened, but it's also an accident you become an artist at all. That's not what your father wanted for you at all.
Yeah. Well, I think that's quite true. I think that I really enjoyed writing about those early years and the some of the strains within the family, but also some of the joys and pleasures. And I even had a chapter about sexual awakening, which, of course, I guess is de rigueur now. You've got to do that because you don't get to be a human being without it.
Well, I don't know. Yeah, that's true. But I was thinking to myself, man, I don't think I could write this. I don't think I could be quite as candid as Bud is in revealing some of these personal side.
Well, you know, George, the funny thing is that amongst my colleagues, two UFO colleagues, two of them said to me that part of the book, they made them extremely uncomfortable, and they were not, they thought I should not have gone into it. And I think not going into it, because I don't go into it at any length, and also it has a lot of humor in it, I hope.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
But the thing is that not going into it would have looked like a kind of a hole in the book, and people would have said, "Well, what about how do you get involved with relationships and with women he's been married and stuff? And how did that start out? You know, there has to be a beginning." And so I felt, well, it does have to be a beginning, and that has to be told. So I went into that a little bit. It's not exactly a sexual tell-all book by a long shot, but at least I covered it, and I just reread part of that today. I was kind of looking through the book, and I think that's pretty well done. It's funny. It's very hard to imagine, to reimagine somehow writing this book now, because it came tick shape over the years. But I don't know that some parts of it I could possibly match today with a slightly tireder brain or whatever.
Well, I really enjoyed those parts because they sort of tell the world how Bud became Bud. And I was just saying, man, I could never write the same thing and reveal this kind of stuff about myself. I think I'd be too self-conscious about it. But it certainly help to create a well-rounded picture of who you are and how you became the person that you are.
Right. Well, you know, I just didn't want to leave anything out. I mean, I had this feeling, when I say anything, any kind of area that is central to how a human being becomes shaped. And so I did certainly put in most areas that I possibly could, and the The funny thing is that, complex thing, is that my relationship with my father, and you mentioned, is not being quite pleased with my becoming an artist. He passed away before I was really deeply involved in the UFO subject, but the problems with my father and still the love and affection that was present at the same time is just very complex. Several people have told me, Jerry Clark, amongst others in his review, that he thought that was the finest part of the book, in the sense that it was highly complex emotionally. There's some material there that was pretty hard to deal with. But he felt it was extremely moving, and maybe the part of the book he liked best. And the interesting thing is, that's the part that my family hates. They all feel I've revealed things that I shouldn't have revealed, I guess. So they hate the part that many people have liked the best about the book.
You grow up in West Virginia with a stern father who doesn't want you to become an artist. He wants you to join him in the auto business at some point. You go to Oberlin College. You discover art. You end up, as soon as you can, making a beeline for New York City. And it was amazing to me that you jump right into the thick of the art scene there, this Cedar Bar scene, where you meet the likes of, you meet a who's who of contemporary artists. They weren't big shots in those days, but became really well known, right? Jackson Pollock.
Yes, exactly. Well, one of the things is that when I was at Oberlin and Robert Motherill came out, one of the major figures of the abstract expressionist movement, he showed slides and talked about these paintings. This was in 1952, and it was all radically new, and I was extraordinarily excited and wanted to get to New York as fast as possible. But when I got to New York, I thought, you know, here's this this rich world of these important people, and I just thought if this is going to be one of the most glamorous things, and I found out that the entire art world was about 250 people. They all got to know virtually all of them within two or three weeks. Everybody went to the same bar. Everybody was broke. There was almost no money floating around. Nobody was making much money, even though at that point a number of the artists were becoming very well known. Pollock is an example. So the whole world which I thought was a gigantic lake, was actually a pretty small pond at the time I got involved. So it was very easy to do, and the artists were very generous too. I mean, they accepted a kid. I was a kid at the time, and some were very, very helpful to me. But Pollock was a difficult individual at that point.
Well, the portrait you paint of a lot of them is that, you think of the caricature of the starving artist, the troubled artist, the boozer, the drug guy. A lot of these guys fit it to a T.
Yeah, well, they weren't drugs were not a thing that I noticed at all in the early 50s like that. The booze, I tell you, was quintessential. So I would say a majority of the painters really became eventually alcoholics, and of course came to very short ends. Pollock, when I got there, Pollock was really practically not painting anymore, and was really a terrible drunk. And the stories that I relay, the anecdotes of my dealings with him, because I was always trying to avoid him because he was trouble.
Well, we don't want to dwell entirely on the art part of it. We'll come back and get a little bit more into that, and then move on to your first UFO experience and how you are led into this kind of research. Stay with us for more of an interview with Bud Hopkins here on Coast to Coast AM. Bud Hopkins, tell me this. Prior to your August 1964 sighting, had you done any research? Had you read a bunch of UFO books? Were you into the topic at all?
I was totally not into the topic. The only topic I was deeply involved with was art, was my painting. And I knew nothing really about the subject. And because, as I mentioned, as a child, been scared to death by the Invasion from Mars story, which turned out to be such a hoax of Orson Welles, I assumed that any reports that I might have even encountered back in those days, in the 50s and 60s, were hoaxes too.
But, of course, you're aware of it. I mean, other people are seeing it. It pops up in the news from time to time in the late 50s and early 60s, of course.
But I paid no attention to it. It was completely just dropped.
So in 1964, you get out of New York to go to Cape Cod to do some painting and relax and just have a different kind of a scene. And you and two other people are driving down the road, 5:15 in the afternoon. What did you see?
As we were driving down, we were on a hill and we were on the high ground. And just before we started down, somebody said, are you looking at what I'm looking at? You know, are you seeing what I'm seeing? And we were all focused on this lens-shaped, metallic-looking object that didn't seem to be moving. But if it was moving, it was moving very slowly. But we were moving, so it was hard to tell. And these little clouds would blow by it, or rather fast, small clouds, and either conceal it or silhouette it, or at one point a cloud sort of swallowed it up, and you saw it silhouette inside like the ship in the fog kind of thing. And so we were quite fascinated and not talking, just looking at it. And as we drove down the hill, we were, of course, looking up at it more steeply. It was off to our left. And it was, you could tell, it was circular from a lower angle. And I was driving very slowly at this point, and we were all hanging out looking at it. And suddenly, whew, off it goes, and it went directly into the wind, which eliminated the idea of a balloon or something. I was trying to come up with explanations, and I hit the brakes. We all jumped out, and this thing flew straight into the clouds that were coming in from the ocean. And at that point, somebody said, "Do you suppose that's one of those flying saucers used to hear about?" Not that we heard anything specific. I wasn't paying attention. And we were absolutely amazed and sort of turned on. We went on to the party we were heading to, and when we went in, we started telling people about what we saw and began to hear reports from other people. Yeah, well, I saw something funny, too, right over the trees. It had windows in it. I'm thinking, what the heck is this? Is this some sort of real phenomenon that's sort of hidden, because nobody ever told me that they had these experiences? And that was, at that point, I was kind of off and running.
And at this party that you went to, I mean, it's not just beatniks and beach bums. There's some really interesting people, an artist colony sort of a thing. Mary Oliver is a name that our listeners might know.
Yes, that's right. Mary was one of the, he was a friend of mine and a poet, a marvelous poet. And she and her partner had a sighting. So a daytime sighting. Some of the painters had sightings. I didn't find sightings from everybody, but certainly there were more than just one or two. And it was a rather, you know, toady intellectual gathering. It wasn't beatniks. That hadn't happened yet.
Mary Oliver won a Pulitzer Prize, right?
Yes, she did. Mm-hmm. And she's widely published and widely admired now.
So you go around the room, you're telling this story, and you tell it to others in the course of the next couple of days. Does it occur to you, hey, wow, this is really, maybe I'm onto something here. Does it occur to you that this is way more common an experience than ever occurred to you before?
Absolutely. I think that's something that continues with people. I've had an awful lot of people who felt they were very alone. They had some weird experience, you know, and they finally, at some gathering or somewhere, had somebody tell them that they had the same experience in a different location. And there's this sense of amazement, like, my gosh, this is really going on. This is a real thing. And so I was just totally fascinated. And I can say, George, absolutely, when that thing zoomed away, I just didn't have the feeling that this could be from this Earth. I mean, I really did have the feeling I'm looking at some kind of extraterrestrial thing. It was, the thought was just there. Because this thing was round, it didn't have any wings or propellers or means of propulsion and whatnot that I could see. And it could hover, and then it could zoom away. And I said, Lord, this isn't something we have here.
And were you hooked at that point? You started reading a lot, investigating?
Absolutely. I was extremely hooked. I began reading everything I could. There were not that many books to read at this point in 1964. And mind you, this is all pre-the Hills case, which didn't really make it to the press, to the public awareness until 66. But just something that's very interesting is that as I was reading all this stuff, and suddenly, you know, convinced that this is very real what I saw. And it's not from Earth. There was a CBS broadcast on the subject, a big, big special with Walter Cronkite. And every single thing was poo-pooed on this program. I remember being enraged watching it. And at one point, they had some journalist, somebody that Cronkite was talking to, who was asked, Cronkite asked him about radar. Had radar ever picked up any of these things that were otherwise inexplicable? And he said, no, we've never had sightings of anything like this that we couldn't explain. And I knew from even reading about Air Force accounts that there were many, many radar and radar visual reports that the Air Force officially called unidentified. So I knew this program was kind of a deliberate hoax in itself. And I found out, of course, years later that the Robertson panel, which had been put together a little earlier in the 50s by the CIA, their official job, they decided, was to debunk things and to take people's attention away from the UFO subject. And years later, one of the people on the Robertson panel wrote a letter to a friend saying how wonderfully the Cronkite program had done their job. They had backed the whole thing, and Carl Sagan was involved with it. So I was aware at that point then that there's some official government policy to debunk and make this whole phenomenon go away, to ridicule it, because ridicule was going to be the main weapon they used, and it's been the most effective they have.
It sure has, and I want to come back to Walter Cronkite in a minute, because you actually called him up and got through and had a conversation with him about UFOs that was very revealing. But before we jump too far ahead, you eventually called the Air Force and made a report, but it was much about your UFO sighting, but it was much later, right?
Right. It was the next year. What had happened, the sighting was in August of 64. When I went back to Wheeling to visit my family, my father, who was a retired colonel from World War II, actually, when I told him the story, he was very supportive, which is interesting. He had no problems with it. And he said I should write to the Air Force and report it, and even though a year had passed. So I did. I wrote to the Air Force, and Otis Air Force Base on Cape Cod was where I sent it. And what I received back was a lot of boilerplate about the Air Force's job is to do this and security and blah, blah, blah. And then he said, if I had reported this in a timely fashion, it could have been investigated, but unfortunately I waited a year to report it.
So on one hand, they're saying there's nothing to this, it's no threat, we don't care about them, but by golly, why don't you report it earlier next time?
Exactly, and what they said at the very end of the letter was, if I should have another sighting, I should report it immediately to the nearest Air Force installation. And I thought, Lord, if they think there's nothing to this, if they think it's merely, you know, old ladies hearing bumps in the attic that they call the police, they're letting themselves in for many, many, you know, false calls, waste of time, and so forth. So it seemed to me this kind of ambiguous thing was really still asking me or anyone to report UFO sightings. So I thought, what is the Air Force's real position here?
Tell me the story about Cronkite. I guess you were prompted by something in the National Enquirer. There's some bogus story or some specious story about Walter Cronkite says, I believe in UFOs, something like that.
Yes, it was I saw this newspaper on this, on the newsstand. Big headline across the front. It was the whole page, I remember. Why I Believe in UFOs by Walter Cronkite. So I bought the thing and read it. It had just come out. And it was written as a particularly personal interview in his elegant office and so forth and so on. When I called the National Enquirer to find out more about it, they said that the writer was a stringer, was a freelancer, not part of their staff. And they gave me his number. So I called him. I just got very intrigued. And I guess the bee was in my bonnet to investigate and actually find out facts. When I called the guy, he had a strange accent I couldn't quite identify, semi-British. And he said, the whole story was true. He'd been up in the office and so forth and talked to Cronkite. And so I immediately called the CBS, and not expecting actually that I'm going to talk to Cronkite, I just thought, asked for a statement. Nobody at CBS had actually read the article. I decided that there weren't many National Enquirer readers at the CBS. But at any rate, and it was also a much more suspect sheet than it is now. But what happened is somebody called back and left a number for me to call to speak to Cronkite. And through the magic of communication, suddenly there I am talking to this voice that I've heard say, that's the way it is, Wednesday. I've heard that voice so many times that watching him, I was sort of stunned. I said it was like talking to God or something, the president. And he explained to me that he'd never met the writer. The writer had come up made up of the whole cloth. But then he started asking me about my interest in the subject, and I had written this article. This, of course, is a little later on in the story. But I had written this article about the UFO landing in North Hudson Park, which is how I really began investigating. That was 1976. And so he wanted to know all about it. And ultimately, I said, "Well, Mr. Cronkite, what do you think about the UFOs?" And he said, "Well, on the one hand, I've had Air Force people who said that they saw it and this and that, friends who were witnesses. But on the other hand, I find it difficult to believe because." That how this could be going on and so forth. And it was, as I said in the book, it was a kind of a typical Cronkite thing. On the one hand, this, on the other hand, that, the carefully weighed. But when I ended the conversation, my wife, who had been listening to my side of it, said, she said, "You didn't interview him, he interviewed you." And I realized that that had happened. I hadn't thought that's what was going on, but he was interviewing me. At any rate, ultimately, I called the guy back who had written the article, and at that point, he admitted he had never been in Cronkite's office, and this wasn't a personal interview, but he'd actually joined a table that Cronkite was sitting at with a lot of other people in the Lanes restaurant, and he just eavesdropped, and he put together, he claimed this is what Cronkite said. The irony of all this was that the man's name was Robin Leach, who went on to do The Lives of the Rich and Famous on television. And he sort of made a profession out of eavesdropping, in effect. And I said I wondered whether Leach was spelled L-E-E or L-E-A, because there's something... as I put it, he was like a paparazzi without a camera. He But anyway, that it was, it got me a conversation that I hadn't ever expected with Walter Cronkite at the time.
Well, we will certainly get back into the UFO incident that occurred that led you to write your first article. But before we get that far, I want to know, after your personal sighting and you start reading mm-hmm. about it and it starts sinking into your brain, how does it affect your art? It, at some subconscious level, it starts seeping into what you're painting, right?
Well, you know, that's something I go into and even have an illustration in the book. But as I pointed out, no artist likes to admit he was or she was influenced by somebody. You know, you want to be sui generis. It's all yourself. I wouldn't have accepted the idea that the UFO experience had anything to do with my painting, even though some other people pointed it out to me that they thought there was a definite relationship. And what happened is I started using, you know, that was so obvious, I started using a big circle as a centering compositional feature in the paintings. And for the next 20 years, I hardly painted anything without a big circle as part of its central imagery. And the big circle functioned two ways. They first began, when I first started using it, the circles were always black. And there were sort of smears of activity which came into it sort of from the outside. So the black looked like a black hole. At the same time that the way it was composed, it looked like it was a black disc on top of everything else. I mean, it was this very ambiguous compositional device, which I found very fascinating, to create a hole in the painting that at the same time was something on top of everything. And so on they went, using these circles, and then I began varying the circles in color and cutting them into sections and so forth. But still denying for a long, long time that I was influenced at all by my experience.
And wasn't it the actor, Maximilian Schell, who made the suggestion, the connection?
Yes. Maximilian Schell had bought paintings of mine, and he was very interested in my work. And, of course, he knew my UFO story. I told people pretty freely about it. And so in 1968, I remember he told me that I should see the film 2001, Space Odyssey, which he said, I think it has something to do with your paintings as the UFO experience. I saw the movie and thought there was absolutely no connection. And actually, I remember not liking the movie very much, which was maybe deliberate. But at any rate, the fact that Schell made that observation, he wasn't alone. Other people said the same thing.
And do you see the connection now? I mean, is it pretty as obvious as it? Yeah.
Yeah, I think definitely. Now, but there was one other thing, and that was the, this has back to my painting in general. The paintings before that were more abstract expressionist. In other words, there were elements that in a certain sense were sort of fighting each other, which was the way of Klein and de Kooning and a lot of other people were working. And they were there was kind of an active fight going on in the paintings to create energy, which was very, very important to me. And it was very important to abstract expressionism, the idea of velocity, of movement. And when the circles came in, things got much calmer. I moved to a more classic kind of emotional territory.
Hey, Bud, we need to take a break. Everyone stay with us. We're talking with artist and UFO researcher Bud Hopkins. And when we come back, the road to alien abduction research and how Bud ended up on that path. Stay with us for more Coast to Coast AM. Our conversation with Bud Hopkins continues. In November 1975, Bud, things are going pretty well for you. You're a father. You're happily married. Your career is making headway. You go across the street to a liquor store to buy a bottle of wine for dinner. What happens?
Well, I should point out that up until that point, I had never really done any investigating of anything. I had just been a reader and a user of UFO material. But in 1975, I went across the street to get a bottle of wine for dinner, and George Obarski, who was a very, very colorful older guy who had a tiny little crummy liquor store. You can't imagine how tiny it was. I used to go in and chat with him about politics and so forth, but when I went in, he was, this particular night, he was sort of pacing around and complaining, as he always did, about things, political leaders, down on the mayor and so forth. And he finally said, you know, I don't know what the world's coming to. A guy could be coming home from work, and somebody could come down from out of the sky and scare you half to death. And I said, what's that, George? And he looked at me sort of like he was going to test whether I was going to make fun of him or not. And, I mean, that was what I realized in retrospect. But at any rate, he started to tell me the story. I went back and got my tape recorder, and which is new, a little thing for me. And out came this incredible tale that he was driving home. He used to close the liquor store at midnight, of course, and then he had to do some restocking the shelves and one thing and another, walked his pack dog, and then he was driving home, going through North Hudson Park, which is right opposite of the West 80s in Manhattan. It's right across the Hudson River. And he was taking a shortcut to go get something to eat when his radio started to go out. And he was listening to some station or something, and he said something passed his car on the left side, maybe, I don't know, 40 or 50 feet off the ground, shot ahead and stopped in this playing field that he was approaching, scaring him to death. And as he said, he really slowed down, and this thing hovered about 10 feet above the ground, then it came down closer, and these small figures started to pour out of it. He thought there were maybe 10 or 11 of them. Each one was carrying a kind of little satchel, which he drew for me when I asked him, and kind of a spoon, and they started madly digging dirt and throwing the dirt into the little satchels, and he was absolutely petrified. He said he was about 60 feet away in his car, still moving but very slow, and he said they went right back up into the thing. He described it in his own wonderful way. He said they looked like kids in snow suits. They were wearing a one-piece kind of thing. He couldn't really make out faces very well. They got back in the thing, and he said it took off incredibly fast. He said it was like there was a giant magnet in the sky, and this was metal. He said it made a little humming sound like a refrigerator starting up, and he was petrified. And the whole thing took a minute or two, a couple minutes, 3 minutes maybe tops, whatever. He drove home and forgot about the dinner or food he was going to buy. And he said when he went in his apartment, he was afraid to turn on the lights because he said, I didn't want them to know where I lived. And he was absolutely terrified. He said he made cups of tea and took aspirin. That was his remedy for practically everything. And had an almost sleepless night. And the main thing then was, he said, you know, but I went back the next morning. He said, I wanted to believe I'd slipped the gear somehow or that managed it or something. And he said he went back to the park, which is very close to where he lived. And he went to the location, and he found all these little holes. He said, you know, I had to stick my hand down in one of those little holes to before I could actually believe it happened. And he said that. Then I went home, and I had to make more tea and take some more aspirin. The whole thing absolutely terrified him. But the point is, when he was telling me the story, the incident happened something like 8 months before. I forgot, 8 or 9 months. It was no longer fresh and immediate, but I was, of course, enthralled. I wanted to find out exactly what happened, and that was my first, the beginning of my first and very thorough investigation.
And suddenly some gear kicks in, some investigatory gear kicks in, and you start playing detective, basically.
Absolutely. And I met Ted Blocher, who was one of the very early UFO pioneers, really, an investigator and writer. And I had seen his name in something that I had been reading, UFO journal or something, and I knew he lived in New York, and I contacted him. So the two of us, because he'd done this sort of thing before, although I don't think he'd ever investigated a landing before. This was the classic close encounter of the first kind. There it was, 60 feet away. Close encounter of the second kind, the actual physical after effects on Earth, the holes. And, of course, a close encounter of the third kind, these figures. So it hit all three buttons in the Alan Hynek schema of things.
One of the things you mention in your new book, Art, Life, and UFOs, a Memoir, is the idea that, you know, it's one thing to see UFOs in the sky a long ways away. You don't know quite what they are. It's another thing to read articles about it and be intrigued by it. And it's quite different to be confronted with the idea that this might be real, and it can really be something that terrorizes people.
Absolutely. I think that the point I made was that people are very willing to report something that seems very distant, lights in the sky that seem to do funny things, but that they're clearly way far away from the witness. And they'll report that because it doesn't really, in a sense, involve them. But something like this with George was something that he wasn't going to report to anybody. And incidentally, when he told me, I should point this out, when he told me about it, he did not know that I had any prior interest in the subject. That was just a coincidence. It was just that we used to talk about various things, but certainly not that. It was all local politics, essentially. So I think that the way this affected me, I'm thinking, again, this is real. I had absolutely no doubt that George experienced what he experienced. I mean, I knew the man. He was absolutely truthful, and he was terrified by what had happened. One of the things you have to be careful with, or you learn, is the wannabe situation where somebody wants to have been somebody who had an experience, a UFO experience. And one of the things that they will usually include in their story is some way in which they become very important, that the aliens told them something, some earth-shaking insight that they have to be very careful who they tell it to and so forth, or whatever. There's always something, or how brave they were or something. But George was simply abjectly terrified, and that was a hard thing for a man his age, or any man really, to admit. It's, of course, a sign of credibility that he can really say that sort of thing, and the fear was enormous.
And this became a theme of yours over the years. I know after you get into the alien abduction scenario, you know, the allegation from the skeptics and the debunkers is that people want the attention. That's why they're telling these stories. And yet you find that most of the people that you've interviewed, the truly credible cases, people don't want it to be true.
Absolutely. Of course, one of the famous cracks of the arch debunker, Philip Klass, well, she said, these people are just little nobodies trying to get on television. The actual fact is nobody wants to be on television. People are extremely hesitant. It takes a series of events or whatever, a coaxing or something, before people come forward because they know the ridicule. They also almost doubt their own sanity and everything. Can this be real? Can this have happened to me? And the interesting thing about that crack of Placid, the little people wanting to be on television, it's a perfect self-description of Philip Klass. He was, in a sense, a little person, a journalist, and not particularly distinguished, who got on television all the time as a debunker. So he was describing himself, but not the abductees themselves.
And speaking of little people, I mean, George's description of the beings that he saw, you know, I don't know, we didn't really have alien grays. The classic alien shape was not an archetype back in those days.
No.
His description of these strange creatures, that also struck you as significant.
Absolutely. These figures were, you know, of course, in those days when it was really early, 75, the tendency would have been for somebody to make up something, would be to create some kind of monster or whatever, some awful looking thing. And these were short, small, and they moved extremely quickly. One of the things he mentioned that was something that turned up in practically all the abduction cases I've ever done since then, was he said their movements were very, very quick and very purposeful. He said there was no wasted time, no wasted movement. And in abductions, you rarely get anything but that. The people don't have to stand around like they're in an HMO doctor's office waiting for 2 hours to get in. It's just boom, boom, boom. They're taken, done with, and put back out again. The efficiency of the whole phenomenon is one of its really basic features.
You, as it turns out, we mentioned earlier in the program, sort of as a tease, that there were a lot of coincidences and synchronicities in your life that sort of led you down this path. This case is an example of it. You find actually there are two witnesses to this UFO landing. One is the guy across the street in the liquor store, and another guy is somebody in New Jersey that just by sheer coincidence you had met previously.
Yeah, that was a pretty hairy coincidence as far as I was concerned. What happened was when I went back with George to look at the site and, you know, to see where everything happened, because I really had no idea of the geography of New Jersey. I realized I had been at this area before, and then across the street from where this happened was a big apartment building. Now, get this for another coincidence. It was called the Stonehenge. And this apartment building housed a collector, an art collector, who had commissioned me in 1968, years before, to do a very large painting for his apartment. And I'd had to go to the apartment to measure walls and so forth. So I'd been in and out of it a couple of times. And then when I brought the painting in, it was on a folding stretcher and rolled in the middle. This doorman helped me in, and it was a big thing. And we had to, you know, angle it into the elevator, and he helped me get it into the apartment and set it up. And when I went back to the scene with George in 75, 7 years later, the doorman who I had located, who had seen the UFO landing, the same as George had seen it, which is a coincidence in itself. But when I actually met him, he looked at me and he said, "I remember you. You're the guy with the big painting." And I said, "Yeah, I remember you." And I'm thinking, this is impossible. How could I have known the two witnesses of this incident? How could I have met one of them like 7 years before? It just seemed impossible to me. And actually, George, I never made that point in public until my memoir, simply because it seemed so outrageous, and I could see it being interpreted 8,000 different ways, and everybody gets their little paranoid mind working, and I just didn't want that to happen, so I didn't bring it up before, but it was always something that that bothered me.
Okay, so you follow a bunch of leads, you collect a bunch of information, you do your first sort of UFO investigation, and you wrote about it for the Village Voice, and then almost overnight you become the UFO guy.
Right. Well, in New York, oddly enough, there wasn't a very, very active UFO group, MUFON or whatever. And so it wasn't something that turned up in local papers. But, of course, the Village Voice was a New York newspaper. And when this article appeared, I was even amazed that they published it. I had written it very carefully and conservatively, and it's the first thing I'd ever written them on the subject, obviously. There was an immediate kind of rush. There were TV trucks out in front of George's crummy little liquor store trying to get an interview. He kept trying to chase him off and refused to say anything. And the phones were ringing and so forth. And I started getting letters. And it's at that point that some of the letters and some of the comments I got when people called George and me too were reporting similar incidents that they had seen this on the ground, people taking soil or whatever at other times, other places. But they were describing something that included some missing time that they couldn't, that often they would say it was right above the car, et cetera, but I don't remember seeing it leave. Well, of course, if you're looking up at some weird thing above your car, you're going to watch it till it leaves. And the fact that they couldn't remember how it left to right or whatever, the people in the car, and there was missing time, alerted me to the idea that there were possible abductions. And I think it's important to realize, George, in 1975, there were two abductions that were well-known. Of course, the Betty Barty Hill in 66 became well-known. And, of course, the Pascagoula abduction in 73, the two fishermen, Hickson and Parker, they made the newspapers. And to some extent, the Travis Walton case in 75, not too long before this George's incident, had also made some kind of notoriety in the paper, certainly the local papers out in Arizona. But it wasn't like people knew about abductions at all. And I certainly didn't. I mean, just what I'd read. And I thought, wait a second. These things sound like classic abduction cases. And from what I knew from the Hickson Parker and the Hill case. And that's when I began to meet some of these people who had contacted me and bring them to a psychiatrist and a psychotherapist, a psychologist, who began doing hypnosis for me. And that's how the whole thing started.
And I know that, back in those days, the UFO crowd didn't want to talk about it. UFO researchers were fine with nuts and bolts saucers flying around, but didn't really feel very comfortable admitting that there were beings, flesh and blood or whatever they were, inside those craft. We'll get into that. And I want to get into your touch with celebrity, being interviewed by the likes of Charlie Rose, Regis Philbin, Matt Lauer, Larry King, Oprah. And get your take on those interviewers and their techniques when we come back. Stay with us in our conversation with Bud Hopkins here on Coast to Coast AM. Bud Hopkins is my guest. Bud, you just related how you got down the path of investigating alien abductions. Because of your media appearances in New York, you start getting all kinds of calls from people relating these unusual, terrifying experiences, things that they don't want to be true. You begin an investigation, and you rely, at least in the beginning, on clinical folks, professionals, to help you find out what's going on in these people's minds. We can't possibly cover all of your important cases, but I do want to touch on the methods because, as you know, I mean, they've been highly criticized over the years, in particular the use of hypnosis. How do you settle on using hypnosis and hypnotic regression to retrieve memories?
Well, the first thing, George, is you find out every possible thing you can find out that the person remembers or about the circumstances before hypnosis is brought into the picture. So you don't even think of using it unless you're pretty convinced that this event really happened and that the person really needs some kind of help. I always went by the kind of rule that if in talking to the person, I felt that their life is suffering. I mean, they are suffering psychologically from what happened to them. Post-traumatic stress, of course, is very, very common. A lot of these people have a lot of trouble sleeping. There are flashbacks. There's a sense of general uneasiness. And some of the basic PTSD symptoms occur. And one of the things is you do hypnosis to help alleviate some of those problems, because the person gets to see or relive, re-experience, whatever, what happened to them, which might be very frightening. But the point is they also find out what didn't happen. There's a way in which the general kind of nameless and boundless fear that a lot of people go through after these experiences gets at least narrowed to something that is more manageable on a rational level. So the therapeutic side of this was always important to me and became more and more so the more I did this work and realized that the patterns were just simply repeating themselves. You know, people were having the same experiences. So that was one of the big issues. Now, of course, in many, many cases, you don't need hypnosis. The person remembers the whole thing. I had a case once, an abduction that occurred on the tape, and the person called me more or less right after it happened, and I think within the next day or so. And she remembered the whole thing. Her boyfriend remembered her return. They somehow, it was brought her through the wall. He remembered aspects of the experience. She remembered absolutely everything, it seemed. From beginning to end, nothing left out. And I thought, well, we should do hypnosis as an experiment and just see if there's something else that happened that she's... And there wasn't. Under hypnosis, she remembered exactly what she remembered consciously. It's something that you use frequently as a therapeutic tool, but also trying to find out the patterns of the phenomenon, because I never knew where the edges of the thing were. It was always kind of, in a certain sense, expanding on me. I'm learning new things all the time.
And as you are, watching these professionals conduct hypnotic regressions, and then later, as you tried those techniques yourself, did you ever see any evidence of confabulation? I mean, does it happen?
No. Well, the confabulation, it can happen in a very subtle way. In this sense, if you ask a really open question like, why do you think they're doing this or something? Well, nobody really knows, you know, what the ultimate goal of all of this is. But when you ask, what do you think they're doing? You might get the person to say, well, under hypnosis, they think they're doing this, that, the other thing. They're filling in and perhaps have thought some of those thoughts before. So there are areas where it is possible, but in terms of confabulation in the major points, it's a little bit like a real experience. If somebody was mugged on Earth by some criminal, the person is going to remember the mugging. They might remember what the guy looked like and so on. But if the police start saying, was he wearing brown pants or gray pants, the guy might think, well, I think they were gray pants, and he's confabulating because he doesn't really know. So confabulation kind of slips into all kinds of recollections that we have, and it was never, as far as I'm concerned, any really important issue in the abduction cases I worked on.
Of course, at some point you hook up with a guy who becomes a good friend of yours, another researcher, David Jacobs, Dr. Jacobs of Temple University, who had written an excellent sort of a history of UFO studies and the early period of ufology, and he sort of follows you down the same path. And I remember Dr. Jacobs telling me in an interview one time, look, if you're going to come up with an explanation that supposedly does away with all these alien abduction cases, it has to fit the facts. And as you just mentioned, problems with hypnosis don't explain away the 30% or so of the cases that occur to people who are remembering it consciously and not
right
with hypnosis. And the same thing being true for, you know, the explanations given by the researchers at Harvard, Susan Clancy and McAnally, who you mentioned in your book, who try to blame it on sleep paralysis.
Well, of course, I just did a panel the American the Association of Psychological Science with, of all people, Susan Clancy and Stuart Appel, who gave a wonderful paper. He's at New York University. And Don Dondere, who's now retired, who taught psychology at McGill. And Clancy, of course, worked with a very small group of people, and some of them, about half of them, were people who answered an ad that she put in the paper, were you ever abducted by aliens? And these people called her and said, yes, they were. Now, that's all automatically such a red flag. I wouldn't touch somebody who answered a newspaper ad. Her situation, of course, with these psychologists, McDowell and others, they don't do investigations. They don't look into somebody's case, somebody's report. They don't go out, as I did, say, with George Obarski and check on the status of the holes and talk to the people who would have witnessed it and the object who lived nearby and so on. They just sit behind a desk and they do pencil and paper tests with people and have no idea really of what the phenomenon is all about. And when I did a Larry King program a few years ago and Susan Clancy was on it, I said at the beginning, I said, you know, Larry, there are two basic groups of people who are sort of interested in the subject, pay attention. And I said, one is the objective skeptic, and the other are the true believers. And I said, I'm an objective skeptic because I don't know whether something happened until I look into it, until I do some investigating. But I said, Clancy is a true believer. Because she knows in advance, knows that it could not have happened. That's her belief. She believes that as firmly as the Pope believes in the resurrection. And she looked a little startled when I said that. But these people are only producing a theory from that they can come up with, which accounts for a certain kind of possible abduction, a nighttime abduction in one's sleep. But we have all these dozens of abductions. When you think about the first two, the Betty and Barney Hill case and the Pastor Gula case, those two cases involve two people each time, and they're wide awake, and they're validating each other's sightings, and actually Hexton and Parker went to the police and reported it that night. Well, what does that have to do with sleep paralysis? Yet they sort of nod to each other like, oh, well, of course, that's sleep paralysis, even though there were four people in a car and it was going 80 miles an hour when this happened, it was sleep paralysis.
Were you prepared for just the whole experience of ufology and debunkers? I mean, did you have any idea what it was going to be like? Because you jump into this and you suddenly realize there are people on the other side that wouldn't believe this no matter what evidence they were presented, and they will do anything to discredit you and your cases.
Well, that became clear as time went on. But, of course, again, George, you have to realize I was looking into this sort of one foot in front of the other. I didn't know where we were going or what was going to turn up or what the phenomenon was really about and so on. I had to learn this slowly as I uncovered the data. And I was very aware because of all the debunking that had taken place before. As I mentioned, the Robertson case officially trying to get the whole thing ridiculed. I was aware of that, and I realized I was going to catch a lot of flack. And, of course, one of the things is to remember is that there were many in the UFO field who were doing investigations who did not want to deal with abductions, or they did not want to take abductions seriously. It was too scary. It was too weird. So I had my own I was sort of fighting on the right flank and the left flank.
At what point do you, how many hundreds of cases are you into this thing where you realize this experience is not good? I mean, obviously it's traumatic for the people who are telling you these stories, but where you start to piece together sort of an overarching theory about what these visitors want, these intruders, what they're up to, and come to the conclusion that it is not necessarily in our best interest that the propaganda that they relate to some of the people during these experiences about you need to save the planet is all advertising.
Yeah, well, that's that became clear. I think they're here to save the planet and so forth. That was so much a kind of residue of the contactee fads of the late 50s and early 60s, and that had been, as far as I'm concerned, pretty well demolished at that point. It was pretty much obviously wishful thinking on the part of the people who were saying these things. It got a revival later, and actually my friend and colleague John Mack wanted to kind of revive that idea that they're here to help us. But the problem is, even though we don't know what the ultimate goal is, we do know this for sure, that people who are taken go through trauma, and that trauma is very, very dangerous for psychological health and stability. And if this starts, as I believe it does, in childhood, even sometimes in infancy, that the same person is picked again and again as if they're an object of study, and you grow up as a little child knowing that people are coming through the walls and taking you, and you're afraid you're never going to be taken back, and then your mother and father tell you that you just have a vivid imagination and so on, so you can't even really confide in your own parents. I mean, in a way, the damage that all of this causes, as far as I'm concerned, invalidates any idea that this is some sort of benevolent mission that the aliens are acting out.
Of course, you go on a number of different interview programs and have done more than you could probably count at this point. In your book, you give a quick synopsis of some of the interviewers and what the experience was like. You just give me a quick reaction, and I'll give you the name, Charlie Rose.
Well, Charlie Rose was very supercilious and very unpleasant, as far as I'm concerned.
Didn't like the topic?
No, he really thought it was just ridiculous.
And even Brian Gumbel?
Brian Gumbel was terrific. I did the Today Show, and he was extremely well prepared with questions. We had discussed things before I was on the program with him. I thought he was extremely fair.
Oprah?
Oprah was sort of, I thought, a little out of her depth. She didn't quite know how to handle this. And one of the things about the program, I had a woman, an abductee from Canada, it was really quite wonderful, on the program with me. But she had class on the program. And class, of course, had this bizarre idea. I mean, the idea was like a weapon he was trying to throw around, that anybody who reported an abduction was reporting a false crime to whoever they reported it to, since abductions don't exist, and alien abductions, and abductions according to our law is against the law. Therefore, they're facing some kind of charge for having falsely made an accusation to the police, and it was absolutely the craziest thing I ever heard, because some of these people, like Hickson, went to the police immediately. I mean, they were reporting these things, and Glass's point was, because many people don't report this to the police, it's just because they know about the law, they're afraid to. So on the program, Oprah, I handed him a letter that I'd written to the FBI when I sent a copy of my book and Intruders, and explained to the FBI that I had a list of many people who are willing to report and discuss their abductions with the FBI if they were interested. And I think class was a little flabbergasted. But the battle between the two of us, I think, kind of got outside Oprah's control. She didn't quite know how to handle things, but she seemed fair.
Matt Lauer.
Matt Lauer, I don't remember very well. To tell you the truth, I didn't remember at all, but I had done so many interview shows. And one of the young men who was working on a film, a documentary on my work and the work of Leslie Kane, these are the people their company is Breakthrough Films. They just did one on a wonderful film on Joan Rivers of all things. But one of them said to me in reviewing some of the tapes that he had of me being interviewed, he said, do you remember being interviewed by Matt Lauer? And I said, no, I don't remember. And he evidently interviewed me when he was not, the major figure that he has become. So I don't remember much about him at all.
You've done a bunch of shows with Larry King, and, it seems like he's got a UFO show once a month these days. But
yeah, King is very interested in it. But he also, if he has a skeptic on the show, like Shostak or whatever his name is, who he likes, he will sort of kowtow to the skeptic. But in general, he's been very supportive, and I feel he's on the right side here.
In the book Art, Life, and UFOs, a memoir, you also talk about a couple of sci-fi writers, and you sort of went into the encounters thinking, well, these guys have got to be interested in this kind of stuff. They write about space and aliens, and Ray Bradbury and Kurt Vonnegut.
Right. Well, I had met Kurt Vonnegut through a mutual friend a number of years ago. I'd come to the studio before I was involved in UFOs. But when I saw him at a party, years later, and the subject came up, he was absolutely coldly dismissive of the whole thing. And I was sort of shocked. I mean, I thought, here's this really imaginative guy writing about, sci-fi stuff a lot of the time. How could he be so coldly dismissive? And Bradbury, when I did we were on an interview program together. I don't remember which one it was, but he seemed sort of flabbergasted that I had photographs of ground traces of UFOs, and he didn't realize there was this kind of photographic evidence. It's as if he sort of had ignored the whole thing. And again, I was sort of flabbergasted. I think these guys. But I later decided, which I wrote in the book, that it's highly possible that a sci-fi writer wants to invent his entire world, his entire universe from the ground up. And the idea that something pre-exists that's got to be taken into consideration, maybe it's too pleasant to them. Maybe it bugs them a bit. I don't know.
We're talking with pioneer UFO researcher Bud Hopkins. When we come back, we'll be opening up the phone lines with your questions. And I also want to ask a couple more of my own about these suggestions that people can fight back and stop their abductions, as well as efforts to catch the intruders in the act. Stay with us for our final hour of Coast to Coast AM. Bud Hopkins, thanks for hanging in there with us tonight. I appreciate you being on the program. John Mack, of course, became a really good friend of yours. It's hard to imagine a more important guy, a more heavyweight guy to get involved in this kind of research. I mean, he brought so much to the field, so much instant credibility. Yet he eventually came to see this in a much different light from you, that it was somehow a transformative experience, that it might be a good experience in the big picture. And he delved into areas where maybe these beings, these visitors, these intruders are not necessarily from other planets, but from some other kind of reality, and that they're trying to help us. What do you make of his theory, and what is your theory now about who these beings are and what they want?
Well, first of all, John had been for years involved in, I would say, a kind of New Age ambience, and was inclined towards something of a Buddhist outlook, although he never was a Buddhist. But he was a very, very kindly man who had had a lot of very good breaks in life. And I think that he was just constitutionally someone who looked on the good side and wanted things to be fine and better. And of course, as a psychiatrist, he's essentially a kind of psychic healer. So that was his take on things. And when he said it was transformative, of course, the whole experience is transformative. I hope my description of George Obarski's experience would suggest that it was transformative for him. It brings an entire new framework of existence really into your life. It's a basic kind of shift. But I think that John, even though the people he was working with were reported great trauma in their experiences, I think he tried to sort of minimize the trauma and accent of the hopefulness. And I think that's just his nature. And I think that maybe I was a little more realistic because I'd had maybe a more complex and rougher life than John. And I was never somebody who always inevitably looked on the good side of things. And therefore, I think we had a basic temperamental difference. Now, in terms of those basic questions you asked, first of all, no one has the slightest idea where they come from. And John's idea of that they may be from another reality, I don't think changes anything. I remember a remark that Scott Rogo made, I think he regretted. He said that the UFO occupants were not extraterrestrial in nature, he said, because they're not doing what extraterrestrials would do. Which is, of course, a kind of argument that chases its own tail, you know. So we don't.
Yeah, how do we know what the extraterrestrials would do? We'd only have to guess at it. Sure.
Yeah, it makes no sense. So I just leave the whole question open. I try to use as often as possible the term UFO occupants. The word alien is, of course, a very decent word because it's a negative definition. It defines what something isn't. When I go to Mexico City, I'm an alien, you know. When one of them comes here, he's an alien. It just means what something isn't. So these folks, whoever they are, I hesitate to call them folks, the UFO occupants, are not coming from Connecticut somewhere. they're not us. So the alien term fits. Now, and it's to what kind of reality, who knows what their reality is. We do know it's very physical, at least one end of the whole phenomenon. What's very interesting is that the nuts and bolts people years ago didn't like a lot of the things that seemed paranormal that were reported, like, for instance, mental telepathy. The communication is telepathic. Figures being able to go through walls or be invisible and so on. They didn't like that, and yet the sort of more New Age people didn't like the fact that when UFOs came down, they broke tree branches, did bad things to the soil, and then when they took people, the people were really terrified and often ended up with a small scars and wounds and after effects. So what you've got is something which on one end is eminently physical, on another end is eminently paranormal. So what the heck is it? I don't know. But the actual sense of what happens in these experiences is so similar across a huge spectrum of cases that we at least know what they are doing is trying to produce some kind of mix, genetic mix of themselves and ourselves. In other words, the hybrids. This is what I had discovered in the 80s and wrote about in Intruders. We don't know what those hybrids are for. We don't know whether there's some program of infiltration that has an ominous quality, or maybe something that they will try to do which would be helpful. But so far, no one's given us a cure for cancer or any of the wonderful things that apparently we could have if they were of a more benevolent sort.
I guess basically you have to follow the evidence where it leads, no matter how disturbing the ultimate truth might be.
Absolutely. Nobody, certainly not I, nobody really likes to see where the evidence is pointing. I mean, who wants it to be this way? Who wants people to be terrified children, taken and returned and scared the rest of their lives in a certain sense? I mean, who wants any of that? This is really awful. This is an intrusion into earthly well-being. And so I can't look at it as anything positive.
I want to ask one other question, and it relates to John Mack and something that it's a sort of a tantalizing hint that you have in your book, Art, Life, and UFOs, a memoir. And you hint that John Mack, at the end of his life, was working on a book about the survival of consciousness after death. Is there some sort of a connection between the abduction experience and consciousness surviving after death, or is that just another topic for him?
Well, I think it's, I mean, John liked to put these things together, the past lives and so forth. That's, again, I think, a kind of a New Age agenda, which kind of slips in. As far as I'm concerned, I can't even deal with it because I don't know what's ahead, whether consciousness survives our death or not. I don't know. I have to be an agnostic on a lot of that. But I do know what's happening and what's happened with the abduction phenomenon, and that I don't like.
Okay, we're going to the phones. Wildcard line, John in New York. Good morning, John. What's on your mind?
Hello, guys. How are you? I'm not trying to debunk it, but I'd like to know, let's say the people that were repeatedly abducted, why can't they ever seem to get it on tape, no type of evidence at all, especially tape? How come they can never have it on tape?
Well, there have been some very interesting cases here where, as an example, David Jacobs, a person he was working with, set up a camera which had a slow speed so that it would record a full 8 hours. And the woman was sure something was going to happen that night. She actually tied a cord around her wrist and tied it to the bedpost and took her two children, little children, in bed with her, husband's away. And in the morning, she told one of the mornings, she did this several nights, she told Dave she thought something happened. So they reviewed, believe it or not, 8 hours of tape and found at one point she sits up in bed, unties the little rope that she had, and she carries each of her children into another room off camera. The next exact shot, the next thing that happens, she's back in bed and the children are there. And there's no film footage of her coming back, bringing them back. So we don't know what happened, how this worked. It's impossible to do this by yourself. So at any rate, there are some interesting clues. But, of course, you can't really tape something that, say, might not have happened for past 4 years. You know, these things don't happen every night. So there are long intervals where nothing seems to happen to people. But it is a very, very mysterious business because there seems to be some alien control over electronics.
And, John, I don't know how much you know about the literature, but there are a lot of cases that are discussed in Bud's books and others where camera equipment, electronic equipment is disabled. And you know, it's easy to say, aha, well, that's convenient if you want to make something like this up. But I suppose if you have the technology to get here from somewhere exotic, you could probably control that stuff.
Well, also, you see, it never works to say, if this were going on, then X, Y, and Z would definitely have been seen, heard, or whatever. And therefore, since we don't have a record of that, all of the stuff that we do have that happened couldn't have happened. It must be somehow a fake. Things don't work this way. I remember in the Pascagoula case, somebody said, it couldn't have happened. They must have made it up because there was a drawbridge nearby, and the guy who sat to lift the gates would have seen this happen if it actually took place. And since he didn't see it and report it, of course, the man might have been asleep. Who the hell knows what he was doing, reading the newspaper? Since he didn't see it, that meant that they were lying. Well, life doesn't work that way. You can't use that kind of a logic, even though I admit we wish we had much more than we have. But we do have, in the case I wrote about, the Linda Cortina case in Witnessed, we do have external witnesses to an abduction.
Very rare. Witnesses from different locations, right?
Yes, exactly.
John, thanks. That's a very fair question to ask. We appreciate it. Wildcard line, Mike in Albany. Hi, Mike.
Hey, I don't think you have enough time to listen to the whole story, but I am an abductee.
Mm-hmm.
And, okay, I'm 56 years old. It was when I was 15. And I didn't think very much of it. All I know that something keeps me from telling people about it. This is the first time I've tried to talk about it on Coast. I've talked about other things in the past. But the thing is, let's see, where should I start? I knew I was aboard something different, okay? I knew I was aboard a craft. I knew that these people around me were the Grays. They had the big heads and the big eyes, and I figured it out many years later that, hey, wait a minute, this is what I saw. And it was a dream. But the thing that tipped me off that it might not have been a dream was I woke up and I was not in my bed. I was above my bed. And all of a sudden I fell, and my covers were all tucked in underneath me, which, was really strange. I was like in like a sarcophagus position. My arms were by my side. My legs were straight out. And when I sleep, let's just say, all over the place. But this was, everything was different. The end of what was happening to me, I looked at them and I asked them, how does this all work? And then all of a sudden, there was nothing but gray around me, and felt like I was falling. And I had the feeling that that's what it feels like to be transmitted. Do you know what I mean?
It's a very interesting account. And, if you leave your phone number with the station, with a broadcast, perhaps I could get in touch with you later. If you leave a phone number or cell or something, I could call you. We could pick it up. But certainly a lot of the things you're telling me are part of the pattern that we run into again and again. So thanks very much for calling. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Mike. And you might want to check out Bud's Intruders Foundation online for a little bit more information. And if you want to leave your name and number with Gina, we'll put the two of you in contact. Thanks for the call. Bud, I always thought the most interesting cases, and they're almost humorous, but they're always pretty persuasive to me, are these cases where the abductees go to bed wearing one thing and they wake up. They think they had an experience on a ship with a bunch of other people, and somehow the clothes get mixed up and they're wearing somebody else's garments when they wake up.
We have actually more of those cases than you would imagine. Or the clothes are put on backwards or something like this. I have two cases where a couple was driving in the car. The UFO apparently stops the car. They get out and they're standing, the woman on one side of her husband or lover or whatever on the other side, and next thing they know, the UFO's not there. They're both on the same side of the car, and a lot of time has passed. And in that case, and another one exactly like it, when the women got home, they found their earrings were on backwards. The posts were sticking forward instead of back. And I don't think in the whole history of the world no woman has ever put on a pair of earrings backwards. It's as if the aliens don't understand jewelry or something. I don't know what that means. But there are many cases where somebody ends up with somebody else's clothes. And we've been trying very hard to locate the real owners, but it seems it's a virtually impossible task, of course.
We have to take a break in about a minute, but I wanted to ask you this, and then we'll go back to the phones after the break. There have been some experts who've written about the idea of stopping the abductions, of fighting back, of using the name of Jesus or other invocations. In your experience, does any of that work? Is it fruitful?
Well, I don't know how many people have tried it, but in my experience, I don't think any of that works. It would be nice if it did. But people think sometimes, I remember a man telling me that he He had, was floating out up across his bed. He was floating towards the window, and he was absolutely terrified that he was going to drop. He had no control or anything. He was on the second floor. And he just wished and sort of semi-prayed, and zoom, he was back in bed. But, of course, what ultimately seemed to have happened is that he had been abducted, and that part of the experience was blocked out. And in other words, he hadn't really, although it might have seemed like it to him, he certainly wanted to think so, that it didn't happen, but it, in fact, it seemed to really have happened. So I don't know that those things work.
You know, the people do equate this with satanic experiences or demons or things like that. I don't know if you can really tell the difference between the two. Maybe we can get into that when we come back. We'll get to as many of your phone calls as we can for Bud Hopkins. Stay with us for the rest of our fascinating interview with the author of Art, Life, and UFOs, a memoir, Bud Hopkins, here on Coast to Coast AM. Bud Hopkins, a question sent in by one of the listeners about your classic books, Missing Time and Intruders. They're still in print, aren't they?
I don't know that they're in print, no. But they're, available through Amazon. You can usually get them. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then, of course, I hope people will check out the new book that we're talking about this evening, Art, Life, and UFOs, a memoir. It's it really humanizes the whole adventure that you've been on, Bud. And I really did enjoy the entire book.
Well, I thank you because, in a way, this is, in summing up my life, it's, in a way, a very different and very much more important book even than the UFO investigations, which sort of seem in the past now in a way, because this book was an attempt to say, oh, all right, here's a life as I've lived it. And I examined all kinds of aspects, intimate and embarrassing filled with all kinds of joyful things and experiences. And I just wanted the book to be widely read, and I hope that happens.
Well, I do too, because it's a joy. Back to the phones. Andrew in Los Angeles. Good morning, Andrew.
Yes, good morning. It's a real honor to talk to you, George, and your guest. I like both of you because you both are seekers of the truth, and you I think you're both fair-minded and very factual. This subject has really intrigued me for the longest time, probably from the time I was a teenager up till today when I'm in my early 60s. I have gotten to know one person, a very highly intelligent person who is a county worker, a supervisor in the L.A. County area, who confirms what your guest, Bud, has said, that he's definitely been traumatized by this experience. And so has his wife. They were both abductees. They're both now in their 70s. And there can be no doubt in my mind that everything that he told me is true. And you could tell it's shaken him to the point where it's affected his very personality. And my question to you is this. Are there any hardcore facts as far as the women who claimed that they were abducted and impregnated and the fetuses were harvested? Are there any documented facts where these women were actually pregnant, where doctor's offices confirm the pregnancy? And secondly, what is your opinion, Bud? You've been exposed to this for a lot of years, and I know you have a sense of what's going on here. Do you believe this is a plan by either interdimensional beings or people from other planets to infiltrate and take us over from within, or to wipe us out and replace us? I mean, you must have some idea, and I really appreciate your answer to that question.
Well, thanks, Andrew.
That's a huge question, and my basic position is that I am a recent grandfather. I have a delightful little 3-year-old and a daughter and her mother, and my wish was always that they would grow up in as pleasant and earthly environment as I grew up in, and I don't like to imagine some of the things you just mentioned as possible very, very negative outcomes. I don't like to even entertain those thoughts. You know, when I see that little girl, it's not something that I want to have in my on my tapes, so to speak. So I tend to avoid answering that or even thinking about it. So I'm afraid that what I'm going to do right now is just simply duck the question. I say I don't have an answer, but I try to remain personally optimistic because that's part of my nature.
What about the first part of the question, Bud, where he's asking about do you have good cases of women who are impregnated and then the fetuses just disappear?
Oh, yes. We do have cases where there is a fetus and it disappears. And there's, you know, there are cases with, of course, ultrasound and pregnancy tests and so on. But, you see, a doctor isn't going to say if there's no suddenly if there's no fetus there. And I have two cases which that happened very late when the person had been pregnant for seven months. And in one of those cases, the woman sued her doctor for malpractice, but there was no way to prove what happened to the child. At the time, she didn't know about her abduction experiences, but so it was just simply she woke up and she was no longer pregnant. And so she blamed her doctor, and of course, there was no evidence that he'd done anything wrong, so she lost her case. But the point is that there is that sort of evidence. What we, of course, need is more graphic evidence of the actual abduction and the removal of the fetus. And that's a little harder to get right now.
Because otherwise it could just be a miscarriage.
Yes, exactly. So that's, even though, you see, there's, of course, a difference between, say, a three-month a miscarriage and suddenly a normal menstrual flow and no sign of any miscarriage of any tissue.
Thank you, Andrew. Vince in Ontario, Canada. Hi, Vince.
Hi. It's an honor to talk to both of you. I had a question. Coincidence that stems in my experience with an abduction experience. Coincidentally, my first traumatic experience happened shortly after I wrote an email criticizing U.S. government based on some data I had read on a Chinese news agency webpage. And I was wondering if is that just a coincidence or is there any history of possibly alien abduction and the government agenda to silence their critics by discrediting them?
It's a good question, Vince, because there's a lot of research on military labs or my lab cases. Bud, what's your take on those?
Well, I join John Mack and David Jacobs in that we don't run into these cases. I have a couple of cases where it would seem a prominent abductee, in one case, Debbie Jordan, who I wrote about it in Intruders, seems to have been an object of interest of the government and some possible abduction to study her for a very brief time and perhaps remove it. And this is all very complicated. She remembers these things. But in terms of some sort of widespread program involving the government and the aliens, I've never seen evidence for that. And I don't see any reason, I don't imagine it could happen for any particular purpose. For instance, if the government had any of the technology that the aliens have, and if, say, remote viewing worked and so forth, obviously the Al-Qaeda the machinery, the people on top, the Nodden and so forth, would have been grabbed, put in jail, and George Bush would have been an international hero and reelected and reelected and reelected. None of that happened. So we don't seem to have anything that looks like it has a wide reach. I wouldn't worry. The number of people who send emails criticizing government is probably thousands and thousands every single day. And I would put this down to a coincidence.
And it probably should be more thousands every day that are doing that. I know I hear the argument all the time, Bud, from, well, not all the time, but frequently from people who say, oh, yeah, well, we made a deal. We cut a deal for technology from the aliens in exchange for our permission to allow abductions, as if these beings need our permission to do anything.
Yeah, that's what's so ludicrous about that. They can do exactly what they want to do. They seem to have the ability to control our behavior if necessary, and to become unseeable when they want to pass through walls. They can do what they want to do. And the idea, I thought when I first heard those things, it was years ago, those rumors, and I had this image of a couple of little gray guys with a clipboard standing in, say, Dan Quayle's office as the vice president, saying, yeah, this is a list of people we want this week, is it possible? I mean, the whole thing just seemed utterly foolish to me.
Okay, thanks for the call, Vince. East of the Rockies, Jeremy in Pittsburgh. Hi, Jeremy.
How you doing, guys?
Okay.
I have a comment and a question. My comment is about a movie, The Fourth Kind, which I believe was made to basically run this subject.
Don't see that movie. It was a total fraud. It is a total fiction, and it is terrifying to people who may have had these experiences. It's really one of the most destructive incidents, really, in recent times in terms of the therapeutic situation for abductees. Awful.
Yeah.
Jeremy, go ahead.
I think the whole reason why they made that movie was to present it. In the beginning of the movie, it says this is based on a true story.
Yes.
And obviously it wasn't. And the reason why they made that movie was so that it would terrify people, and then they would want to know if it was true. So they would look up whether or not that movie was true and dismiss it as a hoax, and then dismissing the whole subject as not possible. You see what I'm saying? That's the whole
thing. Well, I just think that's a very complicated extrapolation on a terrible movie, so I don't know. Yeah. I think they made it for bucks, is what I think.
Jeremy, thanks for the call. West of the Rockies, Noreen in Montana. Hi, Noreen.
Hi, George. Say, just a minute. I want to talk to you, George, just a second. Remember the guest you had on that said these black op military were kidnapping people and taking him to these underground bases and doing experiments on them?
That might have been George Norrie had that show. I don't recall doing that interview. You sure you got the right George?
No, it was on your program.
Well, okay. I don't remember it, but
and
go ahead.
Anyway, so I told that to Linda Moulton Howell, and she says, well, that just can't be possible. But your guest said it was. That's what they're doing, and that's why we're ending up with so many missing people.
Now the missing people thing is a total fraud. There are not that many missing people. This was a kind of a fad years ago, that there were all these missing children. They were being eaten and alive by the aliens or whatever, some sort of foolishness. And I started asking people, when I had an audience of, say, a couple hundred people, I would say, okay, you know, hands up if you know a family where somebody, you know personally a family where somebody was murdered. And you get a couple of hands, maybe one or two. And then I asked about, does anybody know a family where a child, say, 10 years old or younger, simply disappeared forever, and nobody ever had any idea where the child went? Put your hands up, and you never get anybody, which would imply that this is extremely rare. At any given moment, apparently, there are, like, say, 20,000 children missing because they ran away, or they didn't call home, or they were staying with the aunt so-and-so and didn't tell anybody. The next day, of those 20,000, they're virtually all accounted for. At the end of the year, maybe there's a handful of children who are finally totally missing, maybe 8 or 9 or something. But essentially, my statistics are cloudy at this point, but the point is there's no huge 20,000 people. I ask you, as Noreen, I guess is the name, right? Have you ever met any, do you know any family where somebody absolutely disappeared and with no clue at all? A personally known family?
Noreen, I think, is gone. Thanks, okay. Thanks though. I think you made the point.
Sorry, my rant.
No, that's okay. I'll try to get one more caller in. First-time caller, Adele in Katy, Texas. Hi, Adele.
Hi. How are y'all tonight? I want to thank you for, you know, for the subjects that y'all put out there. And y'all really go to bat for us because there's thousands of us listening to y'all. But my question is to Mr. Hopkins. Mm-hmm. You know, this happened to me a month ago. I woke up in, you know, like in at 6 o'clock in the morning, and I noticed, you know, I just sat there for about a minute, and I'm facing the mirror as I wake up. But the mirror was oozing out like another dimension with a big brown eye in the middle of it. Mm. And it was trying to hypnotize me to get close to the mirror. And I became so frightened because, you know, I have the windows covered so that I can sleep good, you know, for the melatonin in my body. And I just became so frightened because telepathically it was talking to me. And it wanted me to get close to the eye. And I ran out. I grabbed my clothes and I ran out. But I knew it was an alien entity in the mirror. But it was oozing out like a blob. And I've never felt so frightened because I knew I couldn't fight this thing.
Yeah, well I'm sorry that you went through this. At least you were able to run out. But this is, I don't know what to make of this account. It's very different. But I'm sorry you've had this problem, but at least you were able to escape. So that's good. That was at the time. George?
Yes.
When we were talking about, I'm sorry to be brusque.
No, that's okay. Thanks for the call, Adele. Go ahead, bud.
We were talking about the interviewers and Larry King and Oprah, et cetera.
Right.
Now I'm adding to the list of a wonderful interviewer, one George Knapp, who had a three-hour interview with me, which I think was you did a superb job of being organized, fair, clear, and all the things that you want an interviewer to do and you often don't get. But I really want to thank you very, very much for this.
Well, thanks, Bud. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. I do have one other question. We got a couple of minutes left. Okay. You had hinted at the beginning of the interview that there are some new directions for your research. Is there some kind of new trend that you're seeing or something disturbing or encouraging?
Well, the thing that's different is it's not really so new, but is the idea that there are growing numbers of reports of what seem to be hybrid beings, alien mixes with us, but who seem to look quite human, operating in the real world along with the aliens. And these incidents, which I've had reported to be, from the early 80s, I didn't know what to make of them at the time, but there seems to be truth that there is some kind of hybrid presence and that they're able to operate in the real world, drive cars, and et cetera, et cetera. I wrote about some of this in my last UFO book, Sight Unseen, but the point is I knew about it for a long time that this was an aspect, but it's of course very hard to get evidence to support strongly. So I haven't really, I didn't make much of it then, but I think it's something we're noticing more now.
And if there are some of these people, if you get the name and figure out who they are, other than just somebody that's seen in a grocery store or something, would there be DNA evidence? Could you figure it out?
That's why it's a very difficult thing. In terms of DNA evidence, Bill Chalker in Australia has been doing work on a long, long blonde hair, which was found in an embarrassing way, really, by an abductee. And the DNA work on it is very strange in that it seems to be closest to some tribe in
Hey, bud. Okay. We're out of time, and I appreciate it. It's always great to talk to you. I hope you take care of yourself, my friend, and I hope to have you back here many times. Bud Hopkins, author of the new book, Art, Life, and UFOs, a memoir. It has been a pleasure, and hope to see you all here next week. I'll be back next Sunday night. Good night, everyone.